Welcome to Real Bank Media's Insights. I'm Jim Renitz, President and CEO of InsBank here in Nashville. Today, I'm excited to be joined by Rebecca Romero-Rainey, who is the CEO of the Independent Community Bankers of America, our primary trade association focused on the growth and vitality of America's community banks. So welcome to Nashville, Rebecca, and for what I think is the second time in just the last month, right?
I'm getting to know your airport really well.
So you want to share a little bit about the convention that you all just had here?
Yes. So we hosted ICBA Live here, second week of March was fantastic. Yeah. We were over at the Gaylord and had 3,000 of our closest community banking friends gather together to really think about, talk about, get excited about the future of community banking. A wonderful event. Nashville's always a great location for us.
Well, we loved having a lot of our community bank brethren, you know, here in town as well. So appreciate the ICBA choosing our location. So but we're thrilled to have you here and look forward to having you share your insights around a variety of topics encompassing the banking industry today. So
we're here for like the next several days, right?
Yes.
In order to talk about all of that.
I know. In prepping for our conversation today, it was like, okay, we got a list of a lot of things that we could cover.
Yes.
As there certainly has been a lot going on. But before we get into that, I think it'd be great for you to share a little bit about your path to association leadership, because I think yours is probably unique in some respects relative to some peers in your world of association management. So why don't you tell us a little bit about your journey to being the CEO of the ICBA?
Definitely. As they say in the association world, I come from industry as opposed to the maybe more traditional track of through government or through association management. So I'm actually a third generation community banker. I was born and raised in Taos, New Mexico, where my grandfather started a bank with the intent of serving the community and really focused on this very classic concept of how do we create local capital and how do we ensure that local capital is deployed in a way that allows the community to continue to grow. And so that literally is how I grew up. My dad was the president and CEO of the bank. My mom was the HR director. So as I like to say, you can imagine what our Sunday dinner conversations were looking like and what I was doing on the weekends. But in all seriousness, it provided an incredible opportunity to literally learn this business of community banking from the inside out. I trained as a teller when I was 15.
I was going to ask that question.
Yeah.
I assume that was at some point part of the gig.
You have to, because you know, filling that teller job when somebody calls in sick, it's like, hey, Rebecca, you're out to this branch and, you know, jump in for the day. And but in that process, you know, obviously you're learning some of the basics, but really for me, it was an incredible opportunity to learn this concept of relationship banking and understanding, knowing your customers and what that meant in terms of the decisions you make, how to be there for your community in good times and challenging times. In northern New Mexico, our economy is tourism, which has a few cycles to it. Yep. And if there's not a good snow year, businesses aren't going to do well. And how do you, as that local community banker, take that into account in underwriting and how terms are structured? And so it really was a fantastic way to see the benefit. And so fast forward over many years, I had the opportunity to lead our family's bank for 20 years. I was the president and CEO. And in that journey, I got involved in association because I got pretty frustrated along the way, pretty early on, that why were these rules preventing me from doing what I needed to help my community and my customers? And I wanted to do something about it. And that led me eventually to ICBA. I was chairman back in 2016. Mm-hmm. And long story short, was asked to consider succeeding Cam Fine when he retired. And so it became a bit of a calling to step in and advocate, step away from the bank, which has been really hard to do.
But
they're doing great. And think about the future of what this industry is and how do we ensure that banks like mine and everyone else's are able to serve their community for generations to come.
So as that third generation community banker, as you shared, you know, you had all the exposure to the regulations that one would need, mm-hmm. Leading the organization that long. So now, having been inside the Beltway for a few years, are there aspects of that regulatory process that, you know, are different than you thought, or, you know, now that you're into the sausage making, if you will?
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is sausage making at times.
Of the regulatory world, you know, yeah. Any thoughts on some insights there?
You know, I reflect back to my time in the bank, you know, kind of having this thought process to myself, why was this regulation created? Why are we having to do it this way? I was trying to find the logic, you know, silly me, in this process. And I think the part that has made the work that we do so important and the realization to me is oftentimes these rules are being written to solve a very general or generic problem that in most cases community banks had nothing to do with.
Right.
This classic sort of pendulum swing.
Or they're reactionary.
Reactionary. Yeah. And reactionary by folks that don't really know how these things work on the day-to-day basis.
Yeah.
And so much of what we do is education in terms of, as you think about these rural writers and their perspective, a lot of times, and no fault of their own, but is academic. It's theoretical.
Yeah.
It's not coming from this perspective of having to work with a customer and work through a loan and know that at the end of the day, you're all in it for the right reasons. And it's just a completely different perspective.
Yeah, I think probably, a phrase that would describe the manifestations of so much regulation is unintended consequences.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, mm-hmm. Because, I mean, as we might say down in the South, bless their hearts.
Yes.
You know, they're well-intended.
Uh-huh.
But they just, but to your point, they just don't know what they don't know. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes, yeah, it's like, oh, we got to solve this little problem. And then, it becomes all encompassing. So,
yeah.
Well, then, along those lines, since the election in November, the number of moving parts on legislative and regulatory topics has accelerated on quite a few fronts.
Yes.
And I know the ICBA has been purposeful in developing a roadmap kind of under the banner Repair, Reform, and Thrive.
Mm-hmm.
So can you tell us a little bit more about the key priorities of that agenda?
Absolutely. And I think this agenda is really set up well as you think about the construct. You know, repair, there's some stuff we just need to fix, and we need to fix it sooner rather than later. You know, shall we say 1071 or 1033 or CRA, which actually was announced earlier this week, is being rescinded. So really just some of those immediate priorities in terms of what is broken that needs to be fixed today.
Yeah.
And then reform being the next piece of this is really about how do we ensure a competitive landscape for the community banking industry, and this encompasses so many things as you might imagine. We've got a quite ambitious list of things that we're targeting, but some examples there are all things credit unions, from taxation to level playing field to acquisitions of community banks by credit unions that we're really trying to solve for. The LLC charter is another piece that falls in there. So really, where are those areas that competitive edge can really be focused on? All things tax policy is another great example as we think about the reform opportunities. And then we get to, the real fun stuff with Thrive as we think about what are maybe some of the structural changes that need to be examined over time? How do we ensure community bank representation knowledge, going back to what we were talking about earlier, the perspective, that somebody like Mickey Bowman brings to the Federal Reserve, we need more regulators like that in positions to ultimately make these decisions where hopefully we can avoid some of the unintended consequences. Things like ACRE, where we're looking at some tax parity for community banks in rural or agriculture lending. And so it really is, I think, a very robust agenda as we think about the future and very targeted in terms of being able to kind of serve up to Congress and to the agencies a wide variety of things that really can make a significant impact and that are needed sooner rather than later.
Yeah, I think that an encompassing theme to what you're talking about is essentially just, you know, a level playing field.
Right? So simple, right? I mean, exactly. But how do we ensure we get there?
And I don't know why sort of the concept of level playing field can't be more bipartisan than it should be. Mm-hmm. But then again, you know, that's an oversimplification, I think, on my part. So, another one that I got to thinking about, I was up in Capitol Hill last week and visiting with some of the members of the Tennessee delegation. And, you know, I think around another unintended consequences, I think one of the items on the ICBA's legislative agenda this year is our trigger leads. Mm-hmm. And that was born out of feedback from a lot of community bankers around the country. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think back to the unintended consequences theme, I think somewhere along the way, somebody thought like consumers were going to be better off if credit bureaus were able to sell their name and they'd have lots of choices. And that's happened. Mm-hmm. I've had way too many choices. So I don't know if you want to share kind of where you think we are on the trigger leads legislation.
Yeah, that one's making some great progress. And I think it's, you know, to your point, it's a perfect example of community bankers standing up and saying, hey, wait a minute, this is something where our consumers are being harmed.
It's abuse.
This is not something they want. It is not a benefit. In many cases, the bank is being blamed when we had nothing to do with providing this information. It's triggered by that application. Yeah. And so and the industry has been great about standing up and giving those examples to members of Congress. And they're saying, yes, this is an issue that we need to solve for. And when you look at the legislative agenda, this is one of the newer issues. And it got really far in the last Congress. And I, you know, it's looking very positive in terms of where we can get it across the finish line through this Congress.
I really, I mean, it last week it felt like there was hope.
Yes.
at least on trigger leads.
Yes. So,
Acre, do you have similar thoughts in terms of the likelihood there?
Again, I'm optimistic today on this one. I think there's some interesting synergies at play. So yes, this does help in terms of level playing field, and folks are supportive of that. And to your point, this is one that we're getting some bipartisan support on, especially when you think about the focus. You know who can argue against ensuring a strong and vibrant access to credit and environment for rural and ag economies? Yeah. I mean, we need all the help we can get there.
Absolutely.
And so this provides a real good tool. And I think, again, as bankers are telling their stories of level playing fields, you know, I don't want to go too far down the farm credit story because my blood pressure will certainly get elevated.
I get it.
We need to solve
for that.
Yes, exactly.
No pun intended for a lot of, you know, banks in rural markets as well.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
You mentioned earlier 1071 and 1033. Mm-hmm. That is, you know, that one's been is complicated. We've got courts and one agency in particular, but an agency that's in flux, obviously, with a change in leadership coming to the CFPB. So, thoughts on you know what we might see there.
So as we're recording this, as we're speaking here today, there is a markup.
April 2nd.
Yes, there is a markup happening in House Financial Services. And one of the bills that's being marked up is a full repeal of 1071. Yeah. And that ultimately is what's needed here. You know, to your point, we've been attacking this from so many different angles. Yeah. But at the end of the day, the requirement for 1071 small business data reporting is in statute, and we need to fix that.
Right.
And so this bill that has been sponsored by Representative Williams would make that happen.
Yeah.
And so again, you know, this is one where we're working towards the bipartisan support. We're not there yet, but really telling that story. And again, this is where the unintended consequences. And what we know as active small business lenders, this would force a credit box. This would create standards that not have allowed me to take into account those unique needs of my customers in my community. And that's the last thing small businesses need in this country. Yeah. And so, again, that education game and this opportunity to say, this is about ensuring access to small businesses and nothing else.
I can't think of a better example of unintended consequences, or almost the reverse polarity, if you will, because you know, the intent was ensuring that, you know, small businesses were treated, you know, treated equally. But the manifestation of it, particularly with the potential impact of, you know, fair lending violations, and, you know, no bank anywhere wants to, you know, potentially be in that harm's way, will be that simplified credit box.
Exactly. And that doesn't even deal with all of the privacy concerns. Oh, I mean, it's just mind-boggling when you think about what this would do to small businesses.
Yeah. 81 data points,
yes.
I think that you know, the CFPB decided was necessary for you know, reporting and much of that public.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I think you know, in the era of AI, you provide 81 data points around, you know, a business, you know, a loan applicant, particularly in maybe a smaller community, mm-hmm. and it's not going to take much to figure out who that borrower
exactly.
is.
Exactly, and they have an incredible amount of personal information and business information about that client. So,
well, hopefully. Hopefully that message can be one that resonates, because, you know, I mean, the whole, you know, the manifestation would be a restriction of credit, and it's the opposite of what was intended. So, one other thing that I came across in discussions last week on Capitol Hill was dialogue with members of our delegation included legislation on stablecoin and crypto, which I think is expected to pass both chambers in some form or fashion. Mm-hmm. And fortunately, I think some things some modifications have been made to some of the original legislation. But what concerns does the ICBA have, if any, about the unintended consequences of that potential legislation, and or, I guess, what issues, you know, should we be prepared to address from a regulatory and you know, banking industry standpoint?
Yeah. So our team has been working this one really hard for the last several years, actually. Yeah. And to your point, as we look at where we are in this Congress, there's some significant support to create this framework for stablecoin issuers. And so there are a handful of areas that we're really monitoring and having conversations on. Top of my list is ensuring that Congress does not grant access to Federal Reserve master accounts to these non-bank stablecoin issuers.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just... for me, as we think about common sense, no need to say more probably
right.
there.
Yeah.
Then there's some areas about, we have longstanding philosophies and perspectives around how you limit the intersection of banking and commerce.
Yep.
And so big tech and their ability to issue stable coins is something we're trying to take off the table and ensure. We're trying to ensure that as community banks may be a source of stablecoin issuers to deposit their reserves, mm-hmm. that community banks could actually leverage those deposits into the form of loans
right.
and utilize that as a source of funding. And we're also trying to ensure that there is a very clear sort of minimum floor as you think about the regulatory requirements that comes to play here. And so, like we said, there's a lot of work being done.
Yeah.
There's been some significant coverage. One of the things the crypto firms were really looking for was to be able to pay interest on the stablecoin, which has so far been prevented in the legislation, which is significant.
Yeah, that's a big one, because I think that one, you know, that one speaks to the potential unknown around, you know, with this is uncharted territory, clearly, and we don't know about the potential impacts on cash and liquidity in the system.
Mm-hmm.
So, in fact, we met with one of the architects of the bill that said, this was something that we felt really good about trying mm-hmm. to do to help allay that concern, which was one of the, one of my greatest concerns. Mm-hmm. And I think, assuming that we're likely to see passage, one of the things I think we need to be proactive with the regulatory community is to say, recognize this as something that's uncharted territory. Mm-hmm. And we're collectively going to have to be prepared for, what those manifestations might be on the liquidity mm-hmm. front. So I think that's what I was, hoping to accomplish mm-hmm. in some of those visits. So.
Yeah. And I think to your point, there's concurrence there. And how do we ensure that there's a bit of a box just in terms of what this yeah. is and clarity that we're not opening up, again, maybe intentional or unintentional, what other activities these issuers would be allowed to do through this legislation. Yeah. So again, incredible work being done. That's being marked up as we speak today as well in the House.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, it's I understand the interest in it. I'm still a little bit of a cynic and a skeptic around the crypto side of it. Now, stablecoin I get, but we still have a lot of use cases around stablecoin is for the purchase of crypto.
Well, and I'm still trying to figure out what is the problem we're trying to solve for, especially, now that we've got FedNow and real-time payments, again, that might be a whole nother conversation for another day.
How fast is fast enough, right?
Right.
One other on the legislative front was after years, if you will, of bankers, beating their heads against the wall around a variety of issues involving credit unions, mm-hmm. and when I think you and I talk about that, it's also we need to be, and I think we're on the same page that we are not anti-credit union, no. We are all for credit unions that. Are fulfilling the original intent and purpose of the Credit Union Act and their mission. Our beef, if you will, are for those that have hijacked the mission around largesse, executive compensation, acquiring banks and the like. So, one thing that was notable is the potential around. It's the area of taxation as a pay for in this Congress. And you got any insights there? It's not my intention to we're not going to necessarily tee this up as Rebecca's crystal ball, but.
I wish it was sitting right here. It'd make life a lot easier.
Right. but as involved as you are, I am curious to get your take on that one.
Well, we can't. Underestimate for a minute how significant it was to see credit union taxation in some form or fashion in writing as a potential pay for it. Now, again, it's on the list of potential. Right. We've got a long way to go, but I don't think either of us would have even thought that was possible 5 years ago.
Exactly.
And so
I would have said that 2 years ago.
Well, so that is significant for me in terms of how good a job bankers have done in terms of telling the story, and maybe how bad a job some of those largest, credit unions who have abandoned the underlying mission mm-hmm. have done in terms of buying stadium naming rights in Washington, D.C.
Of all places.
I mean, come on. the Commander's Field, formerly FedEx Field, is, now owned by a credit union in D.C. And so, those sort of things have certainly not helped their case. Yeah. I also think it's very interesting as I reflect on conversations that I have with members. I was always the one bringing up the issue and, getting, okay, Rebecca, what else do you want to talk about?
Right.
Today, they're asking me questions and it's more of like, okay, let me understand, they're buying a community bank and that taxable book of business is no longer taxable. How does that work? I mean, so those pieces, we've gotten their attention. There is a need to create some taxable revenues today.
And apparently,
so
yes.
we kind of we're offering a win-win situation, So,
well, and I do. I think it's, I feel good about the banking industry's position, which is, again, we're not asking you to eliminate credit unions. We're not, you know, it's like, again, it's back to that level playing field concept that we talked about before.
Yeah. Well, and we've taken our policies a step further. We've drawn a line in the sand, and we're saying, okay, over $1 billion, let's tax those credit unions. So we can be very clear to your point, because I think we all, and the credit union industry does a great job of kind of highlighting those that are still very much serving the mission that I think we all applaud. Yep. And but again, to your point, that's not our beef. Our beef is in this area where the credit unions themselves are calling themselves more of a bank, and that that should just if you want to be a bank, then be a bank and pay your fair share of taxes, and let's also maybe solve for some of the regulatory disparities too. I mean, that's a whole nother.
The fact that they don't have to comply with you know, Community Reinvestment Act is, you know, should be. It is surprising to a lot of people because, you know, again, if you walk around saying, well, we're a bank, you are and you aren't. Right. You know, it's banking services, but you're not a bank. Let's talk a little bit about regulatory environment. You know, so with the change administration, we're seeing a lot of action on the regulatory front as well, including rolling back, you know, harmful rules that the agencies recent, like you referenced earlier, the agency's decision to rescind the final CRA rule. So how did these recent actions and the likelihood of having someone like Mickey Bowman, whose experience as a nominee for the Fed vice chair, how do you see that supporting, you know, the ICBA's efforts to reduce, you know, burdensome regulation?
Yeah, so going back to an earlier part of our conversation, I think so much of, well, let me even back up a step further. As I think about the community banking perspective, we are all about having clear rules and regulations. Yep. This is not about trying to be in a completely unregulated industry. Like there is a level of safety and soundness that everybody is advocating for. Yep. We just need that to be proportionate to the risk that we represent. And I think as we advocate for and as we see the effectiveness of somebody like Governor Bowman and the ability to have that knowledge of being in a community bank and understanding the unique needs of small businesses and consumers outside of the Beltway, it brings a very much pragmatic approach to then how rule writing and even supervision is conducted. And so having that perspective at the table, we met recently with Treasury Secretary Bessette, you know, somebody who also brings that perspective of understanding small business, of the role of community banks. And so again, it changes the narrative of the conversation so that as we bring our agenda to the table and as we think about what we're advocating for, it's almost like you just fast forward that conversation, the point of being able to just dig into the details and not have to start from ground one in terms of convincing why we're having this conversation. But then how do we achieve what I think in most cases we're all on the same page of what we're trying to achieve. It's just how you get into the details and actually execute in terms of how these rules are written or reshaped, maybe in many cases moving forward.
Well, and I think that, you know, what might be refreshing with some of the, you know, some of the changes in leadership, right now will be, you know, having a balanced approach around, you know, proper, you know, prudential regulation, but also understanding that, you know, we're also a part of the, you know, the economic engine that drives our economy. And that's really important too. You know, we need.
If you're trying to fuel growth, just get out of the way and let us do that job, right?
Banks need to be able to help. You know, we're a partner to all the businesses and individuals out there that are driving that economy and you know, making it harder and harder for the industry. So, I do believe that a number of changes in leadership, and you know, I think Mickey's a perfect example of someone who, you know, has that perspective. I believe. I mean, she's a former banker, has seen. seen had the purview as a state commissioner as well there in Kansas, and so I assuming that her her nomination moves forward, I think that would be that will one that will be good for our country, right? And certainly she will stay remain focused on ensuring that banks are doing the things that they need to do to remain safe and sound for our depositors and our shareholders. So, and not to, necessarily promote another podcast, but I listened to a podcast that Treasury Secretary Bessent did last week, and that's worth the hour and 8 minutes. He was really, really good, and it was an extremely insightful podcast. On another regulatory front, I might as a lead on, and I've heard Governor Bowman talk about this recently as well, is addressing the fact that we're going to continue to and be an industry that will see M&A and consolidation. But one of the things that has unfortunately been missing from that process for quite a few years now has been any meaningful de novo creation of new banks. I mean, that's historically been part of that. It's never been tit for tat in terms of a bank. There's a merger and then another bank opens up. No, but there was always some of that sort of creative capitalism that came in the wake, if you will, of M&A activity. And again, I don't know, I think I can count two de novo banks in the state of Tennessee in the last, 10 years. And I suspect most states have had a similar experience. So in that post Dodd-Frank era, what changes would you foresee as necessary to incent the creation of new banks? And I think that that's part that's an integral part of what our shared thoughts are around what's good for our communities.
Yeah, well, I appreciate how you asked that, because it's there's a lot of barriers to new entry and formation today, much less how we incentivize that creation. Right. And so the way I like to think about this is, what is an industry without new birth and formation? And that's concerning. And so, as you stated, we were seeing prior to 2010, upwards of 150 new de novo charters a year. Right. I think there were six last year. Yeah. The numbers, I'm going to not get this exactly right, but 75 since 2010 in the aggregate. Yeah. I mean, so it's just, so to your point, several things going on. First and foremost, the minimum capital thresholds that are being required today are absolutely just don't make any sense for a number of different reasons. You hear a variety of stories of, upwards of $30 million. And when you think of smaller communities and that level of capital, you can't come up with a business plan that justifies that over time. Right. And so we can't think about this in a one-size-fits-all structure or process. And so, that minimum capital standards is our starting point. Place in a lot of these conversations, but then flexibility in that business plan, flexibility as you think about the unique needs of that community how that is being addressed. And so, to your point, I think there's a lot that can be done with the FDIC and their approach, timeliness of response to these applications and feedback on the applications. Yeah. But then there's also some great work that we've been working on with Representative Andy Barr from Kentucky, who really gets this issue and has been an incredible champion in terms of how do we create a pathway to ensure more de novo bank formation at that local community level. And so that also is being marked up in House Financial Services today. And, really to have sort of that statute or legislative spur in these conversations with the agencies will be incredibly helpful as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think in contrast to what I was part of the team when an original employee when our bank was started in the year 2000, And I think I should know the number exactly, but it was between like 7 and 9 in terms of like the number of people that were employed. It's probably 9 on like the day we opened.
Uh-huh.
And I think back to the most recent de novo bank that I was familiar with. And when they opened, I think they had to have as many people, or they had as many people as our bank did at the time. And we were several hundred million dollars, you know, in size. And that's not, probably not their fault, right? Mm-hmm. That's just that the regulatory and compliance requirements were such that to be open for a single customer on both sides of the balance sheet,
you had to have it all built out.
You had to have all that built out. Mm-hmm. And I think that is, that's something that's, you know, we need rational yes. rules around, you know, and yeah, we opened with 9 employees, and I'm pretty sure like the community wasn't harmed because we didn't have exactly. Oh. Yeah. Yeah. So, and to your point around the depth of that capital stack, I mean, these have to be viable investment opportunities for the shareholders too, and that J curve is just made deeper and longer without some reasonableness applied to that process. So, it's good to hear that you know Barr and others are trying to carry that torch for us. So, let's talk a little bit about, you know, kind of, again, that's maybe a good segue in terms of like trends and future outlook. Mm-hmm. I know the ICBA has been a proponent of community banks elevating the innovation process, mm-hmm. encouraging them to invest in technologies to ensure that they remain competitive as community banks and quite frankly, relevant in the years mm-hmm. to come. So, I'd love to have you share a little bit more about some of the efforts the ICBA has been making on that part, including how the ICBA developed its own fintech accelerator.
Yeah, some really, really fun work in this area. And it's, you know, as I think about both the need and the opportunity here, you know, our mission is to create and promote an environment where community banks flourish. And everything we've been talking about is all things advocacy, which is primary in terms of the work that we do. But as we think about the competitive posture of community banks, as you think about how we find efficiencies, how we compete in today's age, technology has so much to offer. Mm-hmm. But how smaller community banks do that at scale, how you do that where maybe sometimes it's hard to plug and play with, you know, different providers within your core. And so as we engage down this journey, it was how can we create a bit of an environment where we fast forward some of those opportunities? How do we create synergies where community bankers can learn more without, you know, having to agree to a contract, mm-hmm. but can network, can engage and really develop these pathways that allow us to compete in this environment? And that led to many different activities and new people that we brought onto the team. But ThinkTech, which is our accelerator, started with this vision of, okay, if you got a group of community bankers together and said, what technology solutions are you looking for that you're struggling to find, mm-hmm. that you wish you could find, that you're just struggling with today or have a great idea for. And then our team went out and tried to find some of those. Do those exist out there in terms of maybe some early startup fintechs that have a solution or an idea technology that we could pull these pieces together? And as many bankers would say, and as we all know, for many of those fintechs, they maybe didn't have the greatest understanding of the regulatory environment and requirements for community banks or how to market or how to price. And so what we did is pulled those solutions together with targeted solutions, as I said earlier. And over the course of a 12-week boot camp, for mm-hmm. lack of a better word, taught them banking. But then we also brought in the bankers and we taught them fintech right. and tried to, as I said, think about a program that could actually fast forward that evaluation and education process. And so we, you know, now where we are today, we are operating 2 accelerators a year out of our own Center of Innovation down in Atlanta. Atlanta, and really some incredible success stories as you think about the number of bankers that have engaged in this process, the fintech solutions that have been developed, and the solutions that are now helping to support the industry and yep. be just really, you know, almost to some extent cheerleaders for what we do as an industry. And so it's very needed, still a lot of work and opportunity mm-hmm. as we think about the constant change and new tools that are coming in, AI, and how is that leveraged? I mean, just there's a lot there. But what I appreciate is that we've got this infrastructure in place and just some really fun work happening every minute of the day.
Well, and I think one of the things that I, as a banker and having sort of been in, you know, a bit of that ecosystem, I think that feedback loop mm-hmm. is really, really important.
Yes.
You know, that you talked about, because I know that our innovation committee at InsBank, vets regularly a lot of you know, potential fintechs and technology mm-hmm. partners, and in that process, you know, there have been plenty that, you know, that great idea, but they just weren't ready for prime mm-hmm. time. And I think what you all have done is a really good imparts that vetting and that feedback loop, so that you know, less time is wasted, right? Like for the fintechs and for the banks. And so I think that's been probably very mutually beneficial. And so it's really good to see that, because I'm a fierce advocate for community banks, but I also recognize that, they're not going to be around if they don't innovate, mm-hmm. you know, and not everybody has to do it in the same way. And you don't have to have you don't have to be on the bleeding edge mm-hmm. of technology, but it's going to be a part of that solution, you know, and, mm-hmm. and technologies and an innovative thought process are going to be critical, you know, because, you know, the future of a community bank is probably going to include a fair amount of niche specialization, and those things are all going to require some technology. So I think what you all have done there is really, really good.
I appreciate how you noted that, you know, one of the things that we absolutely went into this with on day one is this isn't an area where there is a simple step-by-step procedure, because every community bank is going to have a different set of needs. They're yep. going to have a different set of resources mm-hmm. to work with. But it is about where we are on that journey and mm-hmm. providing a pathway to incrementally work through that journey. And yep. so, you know, and again, that's so much of the beauty of this industry is we are a reflection of the community that we serve. How do we, to your point, continue to evolve with that community yeah. and maintain that competitiveness and be able to identify some of those unique areas where we can continue to grow as an industry. And I think the other piece that's been fun and probably one of my favorite ways or times to plug into the accelerator is regulatory week. So we actually bring the regulators in too. And
really?
So, and pair them one-on-one yeah. with the fintechs to be able to hear these stories. And I've loved some of those conversations, because the regulators are seeing firsthand some of the, yep. you know, the challenges and the opportunities that we as the banks are working through, and, you know, have this opportunity to think about, okay, as we're writing these rules or as we're examining for compliance, as we're thinking about vendor due diligence, how does this all work? And, yep. and bringing the people to the table to talk about it. And so, you again, I think that's where the real power and the synergy in all of this is by rolling up our sleeves and just doing some problem solving.
Well, and it's a really good point, because, we get, you get focused in on like the kind of the shiny object mm-hmm. of the customer facing technologies. Yeah. But I know that within our own shop, you know, quite frankly, we've had as much success, if you will, on the back office, eliminating keystrokes, mm-hmm. you know, and duplicate entry, or, you know, all those things are just around being efficient. But yeah. On the regulatory side, I mean, we've all got pretty, I mean, at the end of the day, we have to vet these technologies. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's really, really good that y'all are bringing in, you know, regulators in that respect. And I think I recall, Mickey Bowman being very, very, you know, focused on a lot of things that, you know, are, you know, potentially necessary for community banks to thrive about, you know, working, having a regulatory mechanism for making some of that process a little bit easier. Yes. Now, one other thing, because I know we don't have a ton of time, but one other issue that is, I think, an industry matter that we still need to be addressing is in the wake of, you know, Silicon Valley and the Signature Bank failures back in 2023. We had a flurry of dialogue amongst bankers and inside the Beltway regarding the need for deposit insurance reform, particularly after then Treasury Secretary Yellen famously reinforced too big to fail with some of her post-crisis statements. Since then, bankers, regulators, lawmakers have all, you know, we've failed, and I'll use that word, to get on the same page around a framework for reforming what I think, you know, most in the industry believe in some form or fashion is an antiquated system. So this is a tough one, but what do you see as the path for deposit insurance reform? And if so, you know, what changes to that existing system might look like?
It's a good question, and one where you candidly, and I think you alluded to this, is there's not consensus amongst lawmakers, within the industry,
within the
regulators. and so, but we have to get there, I think, to your point. And so that's where our work is focused.
What's the saying? Like, you know, let perfect get in the way of progress or something along those lines.
You know? That same conversation with somebody this morning on this very topic. It's a bit ironic. You know, so a couple of areas here. There's, as we think about the pathway, the need and the potential for reform. First, you know, in my mind, I think one of the things that was reinforced in the wake of the SVB failure is the realization that the FDIC does not have the ability to implement a temporary account guarantee. That authority was stripped during Dodd-Frank. And so in the event of contagion or some sort of crisis, we need to reinstate that authority to the FDIC to be able to, working with Treasury or however it's structured,
crisis management.
That it should not require an act of Congress to institute tax. So that's one piece of all of this that was very much, I think, reinforced in that situation. The second piece, as we think about deposit insurance levels, as we think about the need or the opportunity to evaluate some sort of transaction account guarantee, where we're really thinking about those payroll and operating accounts that we talked a lot about in the wake of that failure.
Yeah, I've got a peer CEO refers to it as insuring the plumbing, if you will.
Continues to flow.
And those transaction accounts are the plumbing.
Exactly. And then where we run into the angst is then how do we pay for it? How do the assessments work? Because, you know, at least from the community bank perspective, it'd be very easy to say, okay, we're going to increase transaction account levels, we're going to increase deposit insurance. Just do the math, we'll require additional assessments. Some are willing to pay for that, but some say, well, the too big to fail entities have that already.
Right.
So how do we create that level playing field? And so that's where we're diving in over the course of this year. That's where we're engaging in conversations with members and trying to find that consensus, both in terms of bringing the industry forward in the conversation, working with the FDIC in terms of their sense. And then ultimately, all of this will require an act of Congress.
Right.
So how shaping that pathway as well.
Yeah, and I think one of the potential opportunities, as I see it, is that, you know, if we collectively allow ourselves to understand that, you know, so much of the discussion around the cost has been with the not challenging or addressing sort of the diff ratio.
Exactly.
And yet, I've had, you know, I'm not going to name names, but I've had people very, you know, in very senior places share that, no, the actuarial, you know, aspects of the deposit insurance fund haven't been looked at in a very long time. Yes. And so I think, you know, to me, that's a hopeful thing. Like,
yes.
Like, you know, particularly if you think about sort of what some of the more, you know, contemporary issues mm-hmm. and concerns are, the concerns around liquidity flight are so much greater today in a risk mm-hmm. analysis than they would have been in decades prior, right?
Like, yeah, well, you just look at the speed of money
transfer.
We just
saw what happened, exactly. You know, with billions mm-hmm. of dollars, you know, getting into a proverbial vacuum mm-hmm. with the recent failures. So I'm hopeful that we yes. can say, like, we can't just look at it through, you know, the lens of yesterday. Mm-hmm. If we look at it through the lens of today
and moving forward,
mm-hmm. that there's potential for some changes there. Yes. So. All right. Well, we got just a little bit of time left, and I wanted to kind of finish up with you know, getting a little bit of some thoughts around your time at ICBA and your experiences there. And I'd say, what are, you know, some of the things that the accomplishments that you're most proud of?
Mm.
Which, well, there are many of.
Well, and it's, you know, we've got such an incredible team. It's such an amazing industry to represent. And we've been fortunate to have some great wins and to really put some good things together. I think for me, probably one of the favorite stories goes back to SVB and the special assessment came about after that, where, you know, community banks under $5 billion, essentially $10 billion by the time you do the math, didn't have to pay additional assessment.
Right.
For the failure of those institutions. And I'm proud of that because we were able to both differentiate and do something that everybody said was impossible. And you know, we saw a pathway in terms of the law allowing the FDIC to do it. And we spoke up loud and quickly and made that happen. And I think it's just it's a great testament to how to the industry as a whole and what we can make happen. That aside, I think probably some of the innovation efforts, the creativity that the team has deployed, and what we've been able to do is we leverage resources and just a great wealth of knowledge and individuals and people that are so passionate about this issue to really help shape that pathway forward. And at the end of the day, we had record number of new members in this last year. And so that for me, you know, the banker, the numbers have to speak for themselves. And so it is. And that
proof is in the pudding,
exactly.
As they say, right?
Exactly. So. Yes.
Well, you know, I think that you all should feel really good about what you're doing to help enable, you know, better futures. And I think the technology, fintech is the innovation is a great resource for your members. Obviously, they look to you for, you know, advocacy. You have great training programs and, mm-hmm. But, you know, helping them navigate the future, I think is something that is, you know, innovative on the part of the association.
Yes.
Right. There's probably plenty that aren't doing that.
Mm-hmm. Let's lead by example, right?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. No better way. So, one thing that I, you know, in hosting, you know, podcast, one thing that I always like to try to ask leaders are they're continuous learners. Mm-hmm. We all are.
Yes.
And so one question I like to ask our guests is, what's a decision that you've made along the way that, you know, was maybe, you know, a mistake, mm-hmm. or didn't go as planned, but that you learned an awful lot from?
Gosh, I probably...
I got plenty of my own. I know.
Yeah, exactly. Where to start, right? For me, as I think about it, maybe it goes back to the space of innovation, both as, you know, as I reflect on some of the work we've done as an association, but even back in my days at the bank, you know, as we're trying new things, as we're investing in new technologies or programs, sometimes they just don't work.
Yeah.
And for me, the lesson learned in a couple of those situations is, how do you make that decision sooner rather than later that it's not working and it's time to course correct, to say, hey, we gave it our best, but I'm not going to put my head in the sand, and we're going to own this one, and we're going to move forward.
Yeah.
And I think those, you know, I can look back at two situations in particular in the bank and with the association where it's like, okay, isn't what we thought. And
right.
That's okay. Yeah. But let's yeah. own that and let's move forward. And I think that especially as we look at the pace of change in the world around us today,
sure.
our ability to react and to know that sometimes maybe even listen to our gut before the facts are telling us that
right.
It's just so important.
Or you know, allow ourselves to practice what we preach, because you know yeah. oftentimes I've told my kids, like,
yes.
you know, it's okay to fail,
uh-huh.
you know, not miserably,
yes.
but it's okay for everything not to work out exactly. You learn from those things,
yeah.
you know, and but I also know it's nuanced as leader of an organization, because mm-hmm. a lot of times in situations like that, you may have had like a champion within the company or mm-hmm. somebody else for whom, you know, that's a harder decision because it may have been so much a part of what they were doing. And so you've got to let that person know
yeah.
it's okay.
Well, right? and same analogy as we think about the banking industry and a customer that's going down a new pathway or trying yeah. to evolve. And, you know, right. sometimes we may know. And how do we work together through those conversations where somebody sees it and you see something very different? And how do we align maybe sooner rather than later?
Well put. Well put. We've all seen that one. Well, so we've talked a lot about a lot of stuff today, a lot of topics, which has been great. Is there anything that we've not talked about that you wanted to share, or that, you know, that you had on your list of items?
Two quick things come to mind, and the first, you just said it, but we haven't talked at all about the education pillar that is ICBA
yes.
and the training programs.
Yeah.
And this is something that has been a part of our existence literally since day one. It's actually a part of our Articles of Incorporation that we provide education that's focused on the community banking industry, as our forefathers really saw that need. And again, as we think about community banks creating that environment where we flourish, how we train our future leaders, our owners, our directors, and ensure that they have that community bank specific knowledge and resource, so critically important. We just developed this last year a professional development planner that allows for banks to put in place career development plans mm-hmm. for their employees, so you can really think about that pathway for growth. So just, you know, again, I think an area that I'm really proud of and one that is just a pure reflection of the needs of the industry and continues to evolve on a regular basis. And the second one, and you, Jim, are a fantastic example of this, but is a call out to folks in terms of the importance of advocacy and, you know, those trips to D.C. that you've mentioned and that I know you are so willing to hop on a plane and, you know, come in town and let your members know your feeling, your perspective. Yep. We have our Capital Summit, our annual fly-in coming up middle of May. You know, state associations do mm-hmm. that. Tennessee Bankers does a great job of this, but regardless of the venue, just really encourage folks now more than ever. There's so much noise in D.C. There's so much going on and such incredible opportunity for us to think about this pathway forward. But we've got to engage. We've got to tell our yep. story, make sure our members of Congress are hearing from us. And so really encourage folks to take advantage of those trips. And sometimes it's just as simple as when you see the call to action that comes from us of
yep.
picking up the phone or, you know, a few links on,
yep.
on an email. To make sure to weigh in on an issue.
Well, unless people think otherwise, that really does matter. You know,
I can
enumerate mm-hmm. quite a few elected officials that have, you know, said the fact that you're here, you know, mm-hmm. talking about this, and that, you know, there's you know a good audience of bankers that have bothered to do this mm-hmm. Makes a difference, because, you know, and sadly they're you know kind of. There are opposing views on things mm-hmm. and oftentimes they're represented in some form or fashion as well. So
yes.
if we are not going to advocate, others are not going to do it for yeah. us.
And now let's not let others speak for us or
yeah.
think maybe they are, because,
right.
you know, we don't know.
That's true.
Mm-hmm.
And back to your point about the training, I think that's really, really great, because, you know, if you think about sort of, you know, I roll back the tape to 2008, it's almost like there was a vacuum of mm-hmm. young talent in our industry. And I think it's one that, you know, has been, you know, more noticeable in recent mm-hmm. years. As there are more and more bankers that are moving towards retirement and the need to pass the torch to a next generation of leadership. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, you think back to just the timeline, like the financial, you know, post, you know, the Great Recession, like that, nobody was coming into banking. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, that was when tech was just blowing up.
Yeah.
And so if you were coming out of college at, you know, in that last 10 years, mm-hmm. you know, your path was, you know, going towards the shinier object, mm-hmm. which is probably something around tech or healthcare and mm-hmm. that kind of thing. So the more that the more resources the banks have available to you know, provide the leadership development programs and training, the better. So thank you again for advocating for us and for helping banks develop a path for their own leadership changes and needs.
So, yes.
This has been great. I want to thank you for your time and insights today, Rebecca. We greatly appreciate you. Your contributions to the industry and you know, what you're doing to help community banks thrive and more importantly for, you know, their communities to thrive. So thank you for joining us on this episode of Insights.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much.